It's that time of year when the crisp tang of apples lures us into the orchards and then into our kitchens. But when independent producer Patty White's husband Ned and their neighbor Gino Gemaro decided to make cider, they discovered that traditional presses could cost hundreds of dollars. Unwilling to splurge, they stumbled onto an idea. Use a washing machine. From Freeport, Maine, Patty White has this audio postcard.
It all started 5 years ago with two apple trees dripping with fruit, an old washing machine in a barn, two guys who loved to tinker, and the internet.
I think it was just somewhere in the Google search, you know, you come across a hit that says Whirlpool Cider Press. And, you know, once you know that exists, you have to have it.
That's Ned White. He owns the old washing machine. Gino Gemaro is his neighbor across the street. He has the apple trees.
Ned forwarded the link. I think while I was at work, and I remember just kind of daydreaming about it the rest of the day about how are we going to make this happen with what we've got lying around.
There were no instructions online, so they decided the best place to start was to take apart the top-loading Whirlpool circa early 1980s.
So tell me what the washing machine was like when you guys were first taking it apart. Well,
pretty foul inside. Yeah. All the hoses and the bottom of the tank were just absolutely covered with grime and hair and soap scum.
In fact, the bulk of the 15 or so hours it took to convert the washer into a press were spent scrubbing, degreasing, and bleaching. Then Gemaro says they moved on to the next challenge, how to get apples in, mash them up, and get cider out.
I think generally we realized that we needed something to take advantage of the spin cycle since it was the fastest setting in the washer.
They removed the blades and replaced them with a flat plywood disc impaled with exposed screws. A plastic pipe directs apples into the washer to be mauled by the spinning disc.
The blunt force trauma is what we were looking for. To really, you know, we want to be able to bruise the apples essentially rather than slice them up. And I think it's that bruising that, you know, between the bruising and the spin cycle, the centrifugal force of that is where we're generating the cider.
All right, ready?
As the washing machine warms up, White explains what happens to the apples.
The apples kind of bounce around on the screws for a second, and then you see little bits shooting out to the side of the drum. It's just kind of, you know, it's a little like mayhem in there. Mayhem.
It's a little like you know, fireworks display here with apples.
And the result is gallons of cider. It spills out where soapy water normally would, the washer drain. And that left White and Gemaro with their final challenge. What to do with it all? The answer? A party, of course. Now an annual neighborhood event.
Them blowing up out of the thing. Oh, apple juice.
She wins!
I think it's surprising how good it feels just to be able to take something that's been going unused and make it into something useful.
That's Gino Gemaro's take on the washing machine cider press. But Ned White, well, he relishes its oddness.
This wouldn't fall into the category of, like, a machine or something well-designed or engineered. Like, you look at it and you see it running and it's a contraption, which is really fun.
And an economical one at that. All told, the converted washing machine cider press cost no more than $10. For NPR News, I'm Patty White.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This year's Nobel Prize in Physics was announced today, and commentator Dennis O'Toole is thrilled about the winners. His fantasy Nobel team has never looked better.
Today, Saul Perlmutter, Brian Schmidt, and Adam G. Reese won the Nobel Prize in Physics for discovering that the expansion of the universe is speeding up. That's great news for me, since I had Reese and Perlmutter in my fantasy league. Honestly, I could have gotten Schmidt too, but I drafted Nathan Seiberg mainly because he's worked with both supersymmetric gauge theories and with discrete light cone quantization. That was a hedge. Yesterday, I nabbed 20 points each with Bruce A. Beutler, Jules Hoffman, and Ralph Steinman. I remember back in the 90s when I first heard about their discovery of cell receptors activated by pathogenic microorganisms. I was in this bar called the Alumni Club on Clark Street in Chicago. It's gone now, which is fine because it was terrible. Doesn't matter, I guess. But me and my buddies had just polished off a mound of wings and like 7 buckets of Corona when this dude comes in blabbing about the critical role dendritic cells play in adaptive immunity. I almost kicked his brains out on the spot, but I have to admit, the slides he brought made me a believer. Long story short, I've been picking Beutler and Hoffman for the past 3 years, and this time, I'm right. Boom shakalaka. Tomorrow, it's the Chemistry Awards. I think it's high time Rudolf Pariser and Robert Parr got some spect for their Pariser-Parr-Popel method, which made molecular orbital computation way easier than it would have been otherwise. What about John A. Popel, who developed the same thing independently? Hey man, he died in 2004. Thursday, the Lit Awards are going to be announced. My number one guy is Tomas Tranströmer. He's Swedish, he's 80, and he is due. It's his time and everyone knows it. America hasn't had an award since 1993, and some people say this is the year. Baloney. With all the buzz about Murakami and the Syrian poet Adonis, you gotta be stoned off your bean to think Philip Roth or Joyce Carol Oates is gonna get the nod. And don't say Cormac McCarthy. Outer Dark is sick, and Blood Meridian is dope. But if you read No Country for Old Men twice, it doesn't hold up, and the Nobel Committee knows it. Trust me. Friday, we got the Peace Prize. I'm gonna say anyone who is within a mile of Tahrir Square. Or heck, maybe they're gonna give it to that Twitter dude, Biz Stone. Biz can't be his real name, can it? Sounds like a saxophonist in a funk band. Anyway, that's my pick. A couple million Arab Spring activists get to split 10 million Swedish kroner with the Biz as a backup. Me and some dudes are going to tailgate outside the Kellogg School of Management before the economics prize is announced. You should totally come. My pick to click this year is N. Gregory Mankiw. They're going to say it's for his work on menu costs and price stickiness, but that's bunk. It's really so they can hand it over to someone who isn't Paul Krugman.
And that was Dennis O'Toole, a writer and improv performer in Chicago.
Things Considered coming up right after this.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Newly named NPR CEO Gary Nell formally takes over his responsibilities on December 1st. Pretty much from day one, the new chief will have to grapple with the financial structure of public radio. Here's NPR's David Folkenflik.
On Sunday, former NPR CEO Vivian Schiller tweeted her strong support for Gary Nell's selection and at the same time called continued federal funding of public radio untenable. She has told associates the subsidy allows lawmakers to use NPR as a political punching bag. Federal dollars make up about 2% of NPR's budget, but about 10% of funding for public radio stations, and many smaller stations rely on that support even more. In all, it's nearly $100 million annually for a system that includes hundreds of stations. Nell says NPR will forcefully continue to seek such funding, which polls suggest is supported by a majority of Americans.
In certain rural parts of this country, for instance, when you drive across the state and there is no commercial radio covering local news, local government, local and state government, the only place is public radio.
Nell spoke yesterday to my NPR colleague Melissa Block, host of All Things Considered.
We'll have to make up, I guess, as a country, and the Congress will need to decide, as well as state governments, whether this is something important enough to support. I happen to think it is, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
But Nell is unlikely to sit back and just wait to find out. In the past year, a series of scandals fueled opposition among many House Republicans to federal subsidies for public broadcasting. NPR executives quietly mapped out what the public radio system might look like without those federal dollars. Would that mean creating a new major endowment for NPR, allowing it to reduce the fees it charges stations to carry its programs? Or would such an endowment belong to the entire system? The politically tinged controversies cost several executives their jobs, including Shiller. And NPR's board, which is dominated by member station officials, is far from unified on this subject. But the discussion itself is considered notable. Carol Cartwright is vice chairwoman of NPR's board. She says those public dollars are important, but she adds,
I think we're going to have those conversations. There are a number of them already underway, and it's clear to us that we have to watch that landscape very, very carefully.
Two people who participated in the process that led to Nell's selection said he argued NPR has to plan actively for the day that money disappears. They spoke on condition they not be named. On Sunday, Nell referred to achieving possible savings by finding ways to share costs or eliminate duplication within the public radio system. But he said it's far too soon for him to know where to look. Ernest Wilson is a past chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB is the not-for-profit through which federal dollars flow to NPR and public radio and television stations. He said Nell showed an entrepreneurial bent as head of Sesame Workshop. That children's show has gone global and survived a burst of new competitors.
Gary Nell brings to this post a proven ability to work effectively and efficiently and to raise money, which is critically important. In other words, he's figured out a business model.
Nell says NPR should not only draw more non-governmental funds from private donors, foundations, and underwriters, but tap its expertise and resources to generate new revenue consistent with ethical standards, much as The Economist has done with conferences and custom-designed research for clients. Such a course might help provide a path for NPR and for public radio if they were to confront a future without any federal subsidy. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Astronomers hoping to build on the work carried out by those Nobel laureates now have a new tool to do just that. It's a powerful radio telescope located in a remote part of Chile's Atacama Desert, and it may help answer questions about the origins of our universe, about, well, how we got here. Allison Peck is a scientist with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, and she's been working with the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array Project. It goes by the acronym ALMA. Dr. Peck, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Are we overstating the case by saying the telescope is going to go back to the beginning of the universe?
In fact, we're not. Mm-hmm. One of the most exciting things about the ALMA telescope is that we're looking at millimeter and submillimeter light. We're not looking at optical light. We can see things that are actually dark in the universe, things that appear dark to optical telescopes. And what that means is, when you look at a galaxy, for example, a spiral galaxy, you can see the spiral arms, and they're beautiful and they're symmetric. Mm. But in between those, there are dark areas, and there are even dark clouds within those spiral arms. And this is what ALMA looks into. We detect what's actually going on in those dark areas. So these are regions that it's never been possible to observe before. So from that, we can learn how stars are actually born.
Can you give me a sense of how far away some of these things are from Earth?
It's very difficult to describe distances when you get to this sort of scale. Rather than talking about light years or parsecs, we talk about the percent of the age of the universe. Because the further back we look, the closer to the beginning of the universe we get. And so we're going to be looking at sources that are at about 10% of the age of the universe.
So you're basically looking back in time.
That's right. That's right.
Incredible.
We can see the evolution of galaxies. We can see how galaxies are formed, how they evolve, and how they eventually turn into the kinds of galaxies that we see around us today.
Allison, what do we want to know about the beginnings of the universe? What are we looking for?
There are a number of questions that need to be answered about the beginning of the universe. For example, how did galaxies form in the first place? What prompted this sort of aggregation of gas? Did the stars form first and then the galaxies come after? Or were there giant clumps of gas that turned into galaxies and then the stars were formed from this? These are things that have been extremely difficult to investigate with existing technologies. And with the advent of ALMA, which has only recently become possible, we'll be able to look very closely at all of these things.
I know that this might be a predictable or even silly question, but I have to ask, will you be looking for life out there?
Absolutely. There are a number of ways that we can look for life in the universe, and in particular, in the areas of star formation that are close to us. We can look for amino acids, for example, which are detectable at the wavelengths that ALMA observes at. And we can look for the conditions that would support life. And we do this by looking at solar systems that are forming that may have planets within them to determine what the atmospheres will be like there. This will be entirely new transformational science.
Allison Peck, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Allison Peck is a scientist with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. She's also deputy project scientist for the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array Project, known as ALMA. It's in Chile, and it's expected to be the world's biggest and most powerful radio telescope.
It's rare that we get a look at the inner workings of the U.S. Supreme Court, but retired Justice John Paul Stevens, still active and busy at age 91, has made a few revelations in his new book, Five Chiefs. Stevens dropped by our studios to chat with NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
John Paul Stevens, appointed to the Supreme Court by President Gerald Ford, served 35 years before stepping down last year. Retired he may be, but he remains busy, writing, speaking, and on the day I interviewed him, he played both tennis, singles, and contract bridge. Before we turn to his book, I asked Stevens about recent controversies over Supreme Court ethics. The retired justice was always meticulous about recusing himself from any case in which he might even conceivably be seen to have a conflict. So what does he think about the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas engaging in overtly political advocacy?
I'm sure she's acting in good faith, doing what she thinks is in the public interest, and I don't think it has the slightest impact on Clarence's votes on the merits of cases. One might prefer to have her less active, but I really think that's a decision for them to make.
Stephen's book is framed as a discussion about the office of Chief Justice, including a brief history of the 17 Chief Justices who have served over the course of our history, and a more thorough discussion of the five chiefs he's known personally. But it's also a book about Stevens' own views. Taking on the much-debated idea of original intent, the retired justice disputes the notion that anyone today can, with total clarity, know exactly what the framers intended. Nor, he argues, should that intent be the be-all and end-all of the legal analysis. He points to the First Amendment freedom of religion guarantee as an example, noting that the leaders of the country in 1789 were all Christian, and their concern was to ensure that no particular brand of Christianity got government preference. Nobody had in mind any other religion.
It wasn't intended to protect the Muslims or the Jewish faith or the atheists. The principle that was adopted is much broader. It's a principle that goes beyond the original intent.
Of the five Chief Justices Stevens knew, the three he actually served with were Warren Burger, William Rehnquist, and John Roberts. Stevens is not a man with an edge, and he speaks fondly of all three, going to great lengths to describe Burger as a justice who's unappreciated for the good work he did. But in the end, he concedes that Burger had some unfortunate flaws involving his non-public work as the presiding officer at the court's internal deliberations, known as the conference, among them his frequent failure to understand the positions being advocated by some of the justices, leading to screw-ups in the assignment of who would write an opinion.
He might make assignments to someone who didn't actually have five votes for the positions he'd expressed.
Another problem, Stephen says, is that Burger let the discussion ramble on forever. At the beginning of the court term, when the justices would sit down to consider the hundreds of appeals that had built up over the summer, the discussion lasted for nearly 3 days, all day Monday, Tuesday, and part of Wednesday. That changed when William Rehnquist became Chief Justice in 1986, and that same so-called long conference was over on the first day before lunch. Chief Justice John Roberts also gets high marks from Stevens.
He's thoroughly prepared. He's very fair in his statement of the case, and he lets everyone have his say. I think there's a difference between him and Bill Rehnquist in that he allows more discussion after everyone's had a say-so on the case. He's a little less totally efficient.
Stevens blushes when he remembers his first days on the court and his failure on one occasion to carry out the duty of the junior justice. Because only the justices attend the conference, if a message comes from the outside or some papers are delivered that the justice is called for, a messenger knocks on the door, and the junior justice is supposed to answer. But at his second or third conference, Stevens was so absorbed in the discussion that he forgot.
It was very embarrassing. Bill Rehnquist sat on my right and Bill Brennan on my left, and both of them got up at the same time to answer, and I realized I had committed a terrible faux pas.
There is, of course, a phone in the conference room, too, that the justices can use to call out. But nobody ever calls in, according to Stevens. Indeed, if the phone rings, it is invariably a wrong number.
Byron White would answer and say, "This is Joe's Bar."
Retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. His book is called Five Chiefs. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.